Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Yes, we do. Here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio, we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald on a Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Well, we thank Practical Farmers, and we thank you, our listener, for joining us today. We are celebrating the end of October. Where did the summer go? We have had beautiful weather here in central Iowa. The trees, the sun, the little cool breezes in the evening. It's been quite nice. And here we are coming up on Halloween. So tricks, treats, and we've got some interesting things to talk about today. I had to kind of remember how to spell sauerkraut. I've got a little bit of something about sauerkraut later. And Donna's got some words on potatoes. And in the meantime, Donna, I think we should talk about Halloween a little bit.
It's our Halloween show.
Yeah.
Is Halloween tomorrow?
Yeah.
Tomorrow. Uh-huh. Okay. The actual date is tomorrow. I don't know. We've got the autumn leaves come falling down. Remember that song? The autumn leaves come falling down.
Oh, fall by my window, something.
Something like that. Well, okay. So when I was in junior high school, that was a song that we played in orchestra, and I had the oboe solo.
Well, then, so it is stuck in your head.
Well, yeah, and it was just this descending thing, you know, which you didn't have to practice a lot, thank goodness. So that one is stuck in my psyche. And for good reason. It's a very, you know, we love our summers here. Our summers are just gorgeous. I mean, our winters, of course, have their own charms. But right now, it's like everything is dying. This is death and dying season, you know?
Huh? Yeah.
So it's a nod to the, like the old Celtic in the calendar. This is one of the, what's it called, the cross holidays? Something.
Yeah, in between the solstices and the,
right,
and the equinoxes, and there's something, what kind of in the, say we're in the midpoint again.
Yes, so human beings in climates like ours have been celebrating these seasonal realities for thousands and thousands of years. So Samhain, is that how you pronounce it? Which is Halloween in Celtic, it's apparently the day to honor the dead, the time, it's the veil is the thinnest between the worlds tonight, and the dead souls visit their living relatives.
There it is.
So, you know, because it is, it's all the garden died. All my flowers are dead. You know, the yard is a mess and looks dreary. And then until the snow comes and covers it all up, and then you can forget about it for a while. But this is a good time to kind of take stock of things and, of course, be grateful for the bounty of the summer. And now we'll go into the quiet of the winter, and we don't have to be – we can sit around the fire.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. So – This is the time to, honor your past,
mm-hmm,
and things like that.
And in Mexico, the Day of the Dead too. So yes,
isn't that in the spring the Mexicans do the Day of the Dead? I could be completely.
So.
It's now. Well, of course, it should be now.
It is now.
Right.
It's kind of everybody does it a little bit differently, but take the courage to look at death and look at life and celebrate both.
So I'm reading The Grandmother of Time, and it says, according to Celtic legend, the four great grandmothers of Halloween hold the treasures. The cauldron of rebirth represents pleasure. The stone of destiny represents power. The sorceress's spear represents courage. And finally, the invincible sword about which one finds so many legends stands for knowledge. These four older women are often portrayed in folk plays as holding their treasures and naming them. To see them and hear them and their voices is reserved only for the initiated and means good luck. So I hope the grandmothers are whispering in your ears today.
Oh, I hope so, too. Learn from the past and celebrate those folks that are witches, used to be witches. They're in our history, in our legends, but there are people that are witches now, looking to connect us up with the real world.
Used to be wise women. So if you have a wise elderly woman in your life, pay her a little respect. I mean, we always think of Halloween for children these days, but really, it's the end of the year. The children we celebrate in the spring. This is a good time to do something nice for your elders.
Right, right. And everyone has their own way of nodding their head to Halloween. A lot of grown-ups.
Call your grandmother something, you know?
A lot of people dress up and pretend that they are something they are not for one day. And along that line, I want to mention a book that I read it a long time ago, but I pulled it out and read it again because it's got the word dancing in it and the title, and I've always perk up with that. The book is by Barbara Ehrenreich, and the book is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy.
And she is a sociologist, and she happens to be a good writer.
This is actually an anthropological history of people celebrating throughout the centuries. It kind of goes in cycles. There is this human need to, well, celebrate the harvest and all that
community
sort of thing.
Community gathering. Yep.
And what's interesting is there's also a very strong need, has been with us for a long time, for a little bit of play and monkey business. And there's a lot of dancing and a lot of stuff masking and
probably eating together.
Oh, eating, yes. But role reversal, she talks about that, even as far back as the Greeks and the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, there was at least one day a year when people would switch roles. Perhaps the serf would sit on the throne and the lord of the manor would be asked to shovel some dirt. I mean, and back and forth, and you'd have role reversals, and just for one day, and men and women. Men would dress as women would dress as men, and all the jokes that go on. All that sort of thing has been going on
like
for a long
walking
time.
In another person's shoes.
It is. And just the idea of dancing in the street, the collective joy. It's interesting how she follows that through the centuries, because, of course, people tend to do that. And sure can be predicted. The powers that be spend their time quashing that sort of thing. Oh, we can't dance in the streets. That's a sin.
I guess we're just reduced to marching in the streets.
Marching in the streets. Yeah, I don't. Anyway, up and down. And here we are in the start of the 21st century. It seems there's a lot of masking and fun-taking and satire that needs to be done. Let's dress up as your fears, dress up as what your hopes and dreams, and kind of play with that for a day. And the collective dancing in the street, including, of course, feasting, that's extremely important for the health of any community, I would think.
I would say one of the lovely things about our community here in Central Iowa is that we have a lot of public events for gathering and playing and, you know, eating together and dancing together and parading together.
Right. Together is the important thing. Ah, this is community radio. That's a together sort
yep,
of thing.
Yep. We do a lot of that here.
It is. That playing is just as important as working. And we may tend to forget that. Halloween is a good time. We talk about pranks and doing things. Pranks, yes, you still can be kind. You still don't have to hurt anybody. You can be silly. Turn things on their head. It is awfully good for your psyche.
Yeah. Go out and knock over those outhouses.
Yeah. Oh, God. Good. good luck on finding an outhouse. Oh, goodness. So this is a book called Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy by Barbara Ehrenreich. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of 14 books, well, actually probably more by now, and she wrote Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch. Those were also good anthropological studies of how we do things.
She's good with the social commentary. It's well worth reading.
Right. So Dancing in the Streets. And we can do that. We can have a happy Halloween when you do that. Also, speaking of books, Donna gave me passed along. It's nice to have Donna as a friend. But
got this at the used bookstore at the library.
Ah!
Ta-da!
This book is called May Tarts, Sweet and Savory Tarts of Christine Ferber. Now, we talked about a book by Christine Ferber. She's kind of my go-to guru for jelly. She has a jelly
She does.
Book.
And Lon and I both have that book, just mm-hmm. coincidentally. And it's a great jelly book. Very creative. Lots of information. So when I saw that she has a book, My Tarts. The Sweet and Savory Tarts of Christine Ferber, I said, oh, we gotta have this for Lana.
Because I like baking pies and tarts. And so this book, besides have lovely pictures. I have to have a book with pictures in it. They do have lovely pictures.
Yeah, you got to know what it looks like.
She is from France. And so this has been translated. And, of course, you got to deal with the fact that everything is in metric, but that's okay. She talks at the beginning of the book about her parents' and her grandparents' bakery and sitting on the steps because the bakery was in the basement of a building, and she and the other kids in the neighborhood would sit on the steps and not only smell the smells coming up, but she was watching. When she was 11, she was allowed to make her very first, what was it, a tart or something, and she hadn't stopped yet, so very good.
No, and she's Alsatian.
Ah, wow.
North, on the border of Germany, and it's a part of France that has gone back and forth over the centuries. Sometimes it's German, sometimes it's French.
Right,
French for a while, but
yeah, I noticed her references to wines in here and mm-hmm. and place names. That's not French. My goodness, that sounds awfully German, but it is Alsatian. So I said earlier that I had to kind of remember how to spell sauerkraut, because believe it or not, this is a book about tarts, and it's not just sweet tarts. They are savory tarts. I saw a picture and I saw a recipe in here that I have to try that. It's called a sauerkraut and Munster tart. Now you would kind of, oh boy, that doesn't, sauerkraut. Well,
I don't know. This time of year, it sounds like the perfect thing.
It sounds like the perfect thing. Sauerkraut. What a good start. I like sauerkraut. And more people are making their own now. So actually, I got the sauerkraut from good friend Nick Odie. Thanks for the sauerkraut. It started off this pie.
So it's homemade Iowa sauerkraut.
It is. So I'll tell you a little bit about this pie. And this is made in a tart pan. A little tart pan's different than a pie pan. It has,
right, because the bottom can be lifted out.
And the sides are straight up and down. It's very pretty.
Yeah, and the sides have these little curlicues on it. This looks very French to me, Lana.
Very,
it's impressive.
Very Iowa.
It looks very
Iowa.
Very quiche-y.
It is quiche-y. I'm not much for quiche, but since this has sauerkraut, shallots, garlic, quite a bit of cumin, Munster, and a nice custard on the top of it. This is how it goes. First you make a flaky pastry to line the crust, line the pan with. And this pastry has, of course, lots of butter, but it also has one egg and some sugar in it extra. So
it's sweet.
It's good. Yeah. It's good. Okay, so you make that ahead of time and let that rest in the refrigerator.
Actually, not cooked, though. It's just rolled out, right?
Not cooked, right. She suggests just leaving it in a ball of dough overnight. I was lazy. I had too much to do this morning. So last evening, I already filled the pie tart and covered it with plastic and put it in the refrigerator. Okay. While that's sitting there, actually take it out and get it ready. Just kind of let it sit on the counter. Now, these are in metric ounces and things, but 11 ounces of aged Munster sliced up, 11 ounces of sauerkraut, 1 1/2 tablespoons of peanut oil, 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 shallot. I use a very big shallot. I had great shallots.
Peanut oil.
I don't know peanut oil. I used a dash of it, but mainly I sauteed that in butter, mm-hmm. the shallot, the garlic, and the saute the sauerkraut, too, just to warm it up. And then as it's kind of getting brown and things are smelling good, you splash on 5 ounces of white wine. And she suggests an Alsatian wine, but I did not go out to buy any Alsatian wine for this. A good old Iowa from the local grocery store wine, because that deglazes the pan, add a little water, mm-hmm. and 3 pinches of cumin. Now, that kind of saute until it kind of dries out.
Yeah, the cumin is a nice surprise and not terribly French. So with the cumin and the sauerkraut, you're definitely getting a little Germanic in there.
Whoa.
This is good. It's delicious. Okay.
So that'll get sauteed. That gets put on the bottom of the crust. Then it gets covered with the Munster, slices of Munster.
Oh.
Quite a bit. Munster's good cheese. You don't use it enough. Now, for the egg custard, 5 ounces of creme fraiche, 7 ounces of whole milk, 3 eggs.
Wait, tell us how you made your creme fraiche, because that's not an American ingredient.
Okay. So creme fraiche, would you describe it as kind of really rich, kind of soury, zingy?
The closest thing we have is sour cream, but usually cream fraiche is a little more liquid. So some people will, to create cream fraiche, they'll take sour cream and add a little heavy cream into it, mm-hmm. and loosen it up. Or I take my kefir culture and put it in straight cream and let it sit, 24 hours at Oh, my God.
That's what I did. It's like you kind of perk up cream a little bit.
Yeah, it's cultured,
I put the kefir in there, let it sit overnight on mm-hmm. the counter. There. Mm-hmm. So you've got this really nice zingy creme fraiche. And you add it to 7 ounces of whole milk, 3 eggs, salt, black pepper. That gets beaten and put on top of the Munster and the sauerkraut mixture. There it is. Here I am not doing it correctly here. You pre-bake the pie crust for 12 minutes because you want it to harden up a little bit.
So
you don't get mush here.
That makes sense.
So it's not completely baked, but it does have sort of a crust on it.
Oh, well,
and you can use
perfect.
A little egg wash on that too. Anyway, I will do this up and put it on the website. I can copy a recipe better than I can tell you about it.
Well, it's delicious, and you might think for the holidays coming up, like if you have a lot of people coming and maybe they're going to be there for breakfast before the big thing, or they're staying overnight, or
I like it.
It's very festive and delicious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I mentioned this to Donna. I had the pleasure of saying, hey, Donna, Christine Ferber in this recipe book. It was a small, small mistake. It happens. It happens. Huh? So, see, it's a nice, pretty book, and the recipe's on one side. And
she's very experienced.
And she's good. And the directions are on the other, so I'm flipping back and forth. And it said sauerkraut. And the directions, it said to put the sauerkraut and the shallot. And then on the directions, it said, and the garlic in there and saute that. And I go, her list of instructions does not have,
the
list
ingredients.
Of ingredients does not have the garlic. But, of course, flipping back and forth, garlic? No garlic. Of course I put garlic in. Why can't, of course.
So her editor missed that.
Anyway, I put the garlic back in, and there it was. Was
wait
good.
Okay, Evan, come on, tell us your joke.
This had cumin in it. That cumin. So here's a joke.
So is the Alsatian region kind of mountainous at all?
It's kind of just south of the Bavarian area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not flat.
Well, you know, because this whole recipe kind of reminds me of that old folk song. The chef, she'll be cooming around the mountain when she comes.
Yeah.
Three cheers.
I'm cooming around the mountain.
Oh, my goodness. Very good. I'll make that again. So, this recipe will be eventually on our website, the Donna Lana Kitchen website. You can go to khoyfm.org. Find the Donna Lana Kitchen show there under talk shows. And we've got past shows. We've got recipes. And I'll put this one up here because you just might want to try this. It's also, I can't wait to keep on going through this book because, well, it's a little daunting because the pictures are absolutely gorgeous. They may, oh, we've got a pureed chestnut tart I'm looking forward to try. And they're different apple tarts. I can do that too.
Lana, perusing my freezer the other day, and I see in there that I do have a bag of chestnut flour if you need some for that.
Well,
I haven't looked at the recipe,
but keep passing this book back and forth because I think somehow.
No. I'm going to give you the chestnut flour. You're going to do the baking.
Okay. You can do the cooking. I'll do the baking. Now, I can't guarantee that I'll get all the recipe right, but this one turned out pretty darn good. This is a book called Mes Tartes, My Tarts, The Sweet and Savory Tarts of Christine Ferber, and it's translated by Virginia R. Phillips. Nice book. Thanks for passing that along, Donna. This is KHOY, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Well, with thoughts of fall and kind of hunkering down for winter and all those nice meals and gatherings that we kind of plan on this time of year. Oh, great time for potlucks. We're going to be considering the potato. Donna.
Yes, well, like this week I got my delivery of squash from One Step at a Time Garden, and their carrots have come in, some lovely Bolero carrots. So I have my basement refrigerator filled with those kinds of things. But potatoes apparently should not be stored in the refrigerator.
I know that.
So tell me how you store your potatoes.
We have a relatively cool basement, dark and dry. Dark and dry and cool in the basement.
Well, it does say they need a little humidity, but everybody around here has humidity. So
yeah, well, usually in a box with a newspaper over the top, or you check it every now and then, you know, or the box is closed up at the top or something.
Some potatoes, obviously, it's like apples. Some of them store better than others. And, you know, if you're going to bother to store them, they need to be not in plastic, and someplace where the air can circulate around them. And probably once a month you need to go and at least sniff test them, because if you smell anything sour and there's one bad one in there, you have to go, because it's like apples. One bad apple in the barrel will spoil the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, so I don't really have a good storage space because...
Well, you've got a basement.
Yeah, but I have critters in the basement.
Well, then some sort of like mesh proof sort of...
Yeah. The other thing is also my gas furnace is in the basement, and that keeps the basement a little bit too warm.
Oh.
You need it to be... It's root cellar is what people really need. So you need about... 40 to 50 degrees, and darkness.
Darkness is good. Potatoes have this habit. Well, they're a plant. They're a tuber. That's where next year's growth comes from.
Right. They keep changing.
Right.
And they have eyes.
Why they call them eyes, I don't know, because it sprouts out of the eyes. But that's where they tend to get really busy.
Yeah, and when you're storing potatoes, much like you would an apple or something, if the skin is broken or, you know, it has a puncture hole or an animal has eaten it, don't store that one. Just put it aside.
Eat it
right away, because that will start to go bad and spoil the rest of them. Also, you have to store potatoes separate from onions and fruits, because those give off the ethylene gas and it will cause the potatoes to sprout prematurely.
Oh, yes. Well, that's annoying.
Right.
The idea of I can't say that I do this religiously, but a good way to check potatoes is just take another box to the basement with you and just slowly pour them out. Just kind of pour them, upend them, push them around a little bit. Then you can see what's going on. But don't be harsh on them. I mean, they're sleeping. So, yeah, leave them down.
Yeah, and the other thing, which if your potato has turned slightly greenish, not bright green, but just a greenish tint to it, do not eat that part.
Yes.
You either have to cut it off, and if the whole potato is green, throw it away, because you can make yourself ill eating that.
Yep. It's trying really hard to create a lot of chlorophyll in there, and it's good for the potato, but it is not good for you.
One time I forgot to do that, and we were merrily eating some lovely potato soup, and afterwards we were a little bit dizzy, and I went, oh, oops, that's what that is. You really mustn't eat that.
Right. I've had stomach upset doing it. I mean, you do it once, maybe you do it twice if you're a little stubborn, but don't do it again.
Well, and if it's really serious, you can make yourself quite ill. So remember, if it's green, just cut that part off.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it starts from the peel and goes in, and that's one of the reasons to store them. So if you're like me and you don't have a way of storing potatoes very well, don't store them in plastic bags, even if you bought them in the plastic bag. Usually you'll see in the store the plastic bags will have holes punched into them because it has to breathe. I just have to buy my potatoes as I need them. So what kind of potatoes did you grow or harvest this year?
Let's see. I don't know the kind. I had a lovely little fingerling potato given to me by my friend Sam, and I've yet to figure out what the heck that potato is. Fingerling potatoes they're supposed to be small. They're long. They're finger-shaped. And for many years, I grew them, and I thought, why am I bothering? I like big potatoes or, you know, something with that. But this year, the fingerlings were quite nice. Those are good. And I have grown one of my favorites is called Kerala.
With a C, yes.
With a C. Mm-hmm. And that is a lovely all-purpose potato. It's reddish on the outside and goldish on the inside. I've also grown yellowfin, Yukon Gold.
Love the yellowfin. Oh, I mean, there's no bad potato.
Yukon Golds are very, very popular. I found that the yellowfin, which is similar, actually grows better on my farm. My soil is a little heavier.
The yellowfin is even a little richer than the Yukon Gold.
Maybe. You find what kind of potato that you actually can grow. And then there's the Vikings and the Kennebecs for the big bakers. But I kind of like the little waxy ones. That's a potato term, isn't it? Waxy.
Yeah, a waxy potato. But, you know, the good old russet. I still love a good old russet. There's nothing like it. I like to use russets for mashing potatoes. They're fluffy. They're dry.
Mm-hmm. Question. Do you peel your potatoes when you mash them, or do you leave them kind of chunky and skin on?
Here's what I do.
Okay.
Technically, mashed potatoes should be peeled, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the classic mashed potato. So what I do is I call them smashed potatoes, right? Because then no one minds the lumps. You can leave the skin on. Some potatoes, the skin is I don't know. The thing is, when you do a baked potato with a russet, do you eat the skin?
I usually do.
I do, too.
I love the skin.
I do, too. But not everyone does. So at least in my internal processing, if it's a smashed potato recipe, it can have lumps and skin.
Mm-hmm.
If it's mashed potatoes, you really kind of have to, I do love mashed potatoes, but they are a lot more work. You have
to
peel them. And then I use my mother's, the thing I use for all my fruit purees and everything. She used to call it a potato ricer. It's that conical thing with the wooden, and I run my mashed potato stuff through that. I mean, you have to cook them to do that.
My mom always used to run them through the Foley food mill.
Yes,
Boy, you can make a mess with that.
Yes, you can. But you can get perfect mashed potatoes that way. I have to really want them to do that. Another thing that I love to make that is simple as can be is I simply throw some not peeled but cleaned and sliced potatoes in some water with an onion and a bay leaf. And cook it till they're mushy, take the bay leaf out, puree the whole thing, salt, pepper, and a little milk or cream, and you got the best potato soup in the world.
Oh, for goodness. Use a immersible blender?
You can do that, or sometimes I just put it in my blender and add the milk or chicken stock or whatever you're doing. But, you know, nothing like potato soup in the middle of the cold weather.
Yeah, and you don't think about it all summer? And then, you get hungry for potatoes this time of year. And then you could add things. I'm a big rutabaga fan, actually.
And rutabaga, I love mixing potatoes and rutabaga.
Now, just rutabagas by itself are fine, but mixing them together,
that's
so
another
good
one for called the smashed rutabaga potato mixture. And a third thing that I like, I personally don't like putting the turnips in, but some people do.
Yeah.
But celery root.
Uh-huh.
So celery root, rutabaga, and potato, I think all go together charmingly.
Now, see, something I haven't tried. Celery root is one of those foreign vegetables. I have not put those. I've had celery root.
Well, they're not really foreign. We grow them here in Iowa. We got out of the habit, I guess.
Got out of the habit.
But they are, they're good if you cube them all up and roast them with a little oil on them and some onions and garlic and herbs or in a soup or even a stew. Mm-hmm. Those three together are just, I think, sublime.
Good. We've been talking about potatoes and we've been talking about kind of boiling them up and steaming them and more mushing.
Boil, steam, bake, roast.
Potatoes also, actually, I love this. Potatoes also are really good fried. I'm a fried potato for breakfast sort of person. And if I happen to remember to actually bake up a few, That's ever so much easier because they take a long time.
Okay, you want to know a good cheat?
Oh, give me a cheat.
I found it in Wheatsfield in the frozen vegetable department, right, in the little plastic bags where you could buy, you know, the shredded potatoes to make hash browns. There's now a mixture that has other root vegetables in it with the potatoes. So you just got that sticking in your freezer, you haul it out for Sunday morning, throw it in the frying pan. It's delicious. Oh. And it would be good in soups, too. But it's already mixed, already shredded.
Is it kind of pre-cooked or just shredded?
I think it's just shredded. You know, like frozen hash browns.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
You know?
That's good.
Couldn't be more delicious.
Oh, Evan, our ever on top of it engineer here, has a little information for us about that green stuff that we've been talking about on potatoes. The green chlorophyll is a byproduct called solanine.
Says here, a chemical that causes potatoes to turn green, produces a bitter taste, and if eaten in large quantities can cause illness.
And you'll love this part, actually. It's also a member of the nightshade family.
Aha! Speaking of making brews for Halloween, put a little nightshade.
Put a little solanine in there, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Well, now, nightshades are potatoes. They're also peppers and tomatoes, eggplant. Those are all nightshades. And yes, people did used to think that stuff was poisonous when it came back from the New World to the Old World. Oh, you wouldn't eat. Potato was kind of a strange, awful thing.
Do we know where that term nightshade comes from? Anybody know?
I'll check real quick.
Oh, I maybe it has to do with the
I mean, it's a rather evocative phrase. You know, the nightshade.
The white flowers on it, perhaps? I mean,
do they all have white flowers? Potatoes have white flowers?
No, they're kind of purplish. Well, it depends. Purplish, pinkish, whitish. I'm trying to think of, I don't know, maybe it's just the shape of the plant. Or maybe the fact that it was kind of one of those plants you should look out for.
Okay, so it's actually Old English is the etymological origin. Nightshade, which is apparently from night and shade, and it's thought to be a reference to the dark color and poisonous properties of the berries.
Berries, that's it. Yes.
Potato berries? Who knew?
No, potatoes do get berries.
Do they?
I had to learn this, too. We always think of planting the potato because it grows from the tuber. But the plant is still doing a plant. It still does flowers. It still does.
So it's still making a seed in the berry.
Actually, that's how people breed new kind of potatoes. People that really know how to fuss with that sort of thing can get up there in with the seeds and, nightshade. Thanks, Evan. That was good. Nightshade.
So, right. Eggplants have seeds in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And peppers and...
Yeah, they all have seeds in them. I guess that's the deal. Okay.
Very good. Potatoes. Oh, very good. And potatoes take into seasonings, all kinds of things.
Knowledgeable group here. My. You can find out anything on the internet, apparently.
Great. This is KHOI, and you're listening to the Down in the Kitchen. Here's a little tune about food. It's always nice to get tunes that have food themes.
Yeah, that's Lana's specialty.
In case you haven't noticed, right? And this is kind of thinking of fall. This one's called Cornbread, Molasses, and Sassafras Tea. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking fall foods. We're talking sauerkraut tart, potatoes, and a little bit of Halloween things here. That was a tune called Cornbread Molasses and Sassafras Tea by the band The Freight Hoppers. Yes, it was. Sassafras tea. Oh, yes. It's something made from tree bark. And our font of all wisdom here, our engineer, Evan Taylor, says, you can get some hallucinogens and some interesting other things from that same tree. So sassafras.
Oh, those plants. You watch out for those plants.
Gotta watch for that. The sassafras tea, yes. Mm-hmm. I like that. So we try to keep up on latest news items here. And so the Donna Lana Kitchen News Department has a little something for you. Tick-a-tick, 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 tick-a-tick. That's the Donna Lana Kitchen ticker tape. So, Donna, what do you have for us today?
Yes, I got a heads up this week from Chuck Benbrook, Dr. Chuck Benbrook, our font of wisdom in all things in terms of chemicals in the food systems and things like that. So he's a fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for the Future of Livable Future or something like that. Anyway, and Chuck was one of the people who testified at the trial against Monsanto for that groundskeeper that has the first ever cancer award for possibly getting cancer from using Roundup.
So, I remember that.
So
yeah.
Chuck's right out there staying on top of all of this. And fortunately, he kind of gives me a heads up when something comes out. And this week, now this is something a long time coming, right? So, and it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So this is not a fly-by-night, small-time thing. This is a surprising new epidemiological, there we go, paper in JAMA. The research was done by the French government scientists, very large study, just under 69,000 people, right? So this is not just, maybe somebody. The report, the conclusion is a 25% decrease in cancer risk among all of those thousands of people, 29% overall cancer reduction.
What did they do?
For eating mostly organic food.
Mostly
organic food. They're hypothesizing because there were a couple of specific cancers, including I think postmenopausal breast cancer had a very much larger reduction, as well as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this is the third study like this to report the link. So they're supposing that the reason they're having this cancer reduction, ready? Go figure. This is shocking. It's because of reduced exposure to pesticides. So if you're eating organic food mostly, you are lowering your exposure to pesticides. And thus, according to this study, of course, people are going to say yes and no. But what's going to happen because of this study, because it was so rigorously done and such a large number, longitude means they used a lot of people over a long period of time to draw this conclusion. So obviously more research now will seriously be done on the effects of either food with reduced pesticides or organic diets. And as we have been saying all along, if you are buying and eating mostly organic foods, you are getting, we were unable in this culture to get a label that specifies that it is not grown with genetic GMOs, right? But organic foods cannot be grown with GMOs, and they also cannot have pesticides and nitrogen fertilizers and all of those things applied. There are other ways to grow food that make it perfectly tasty. I, for one, am looking forward to, and this it will be still longer, but some smaller studies have also been shown that because organic farming must build the soil rather than just, you know, pouring on the NKP, organic fruits and vegetables quite possibly have higher nutrient value as well.
That is an interesting thing. I've heard that mentioned before.
Well, it's very expensive and takes a long time to do these studies, and there are lots of major forces, moneyed forces in the food industry that don't particularly care to have this information. So getting this work done, obviously the French government has stepped up and kind of proven a rather significant, while obvious to many of us, you know, it's not been provable before. So this is, at the very least, the beginning of the possibility of more science to shed light on these issues.
Good.
You know, science in the public interest, as we would say.
That sounds pretty good.
I know.
So eating organic food
reduces cancer incidences in up to 25% just across the board.
It kind of makes sense. And for those of us who have to have numbers and
proof
and proof and science and people in white coats.
There it is.
They're working on it.
There it is. And I, you know, I know that Chuck has been working on this kind of science for, oh, goodness, 25 or 30, a long time. It takes a long time. And the, you know, if you're using the precautionary principle, this is a very, very good example. All of these agricultural techniques have been widely applied. People have been consuming them for years, and we're just now proving the science. So we did not prove lack of harm before we put these things into the food system. So moving forward into our highly technological and with possibly many wonderful advances, but not all of them are going to be good. Let's ask a lot of questions. Let's try to do no harm, okay? In this instance, there we go. You know, we spray a lot of pesticides on our food, and we're beginning to wonder, is this a good thing? But at this point, the whole agricultural system, especially here in Iowa, is built on that.
We are swimming in the stuff.
Oh, boy. And for Iowa, glyphosate is a big deal.
Even those of us who, we've tried to eat organic, we grow a lot of our own food. It's
around here, it's probably in the soil, maybe in the air, probably in the water.
The latest thing in the news, too, is that not only pesticides, but they're finding little bits of plastic inside of all of us, too.
We have to remember that glyphosate is an herbicide.
Yeah, right.
So plastics, herbicides, pesticides. Oh, my.
Let's kind of be very mindful of what we put in our body. Thanks for that little report from Dr. Chuck Benbrook about organic food and instances of cancer. Be healthy out there, folks.
Well, we'll just all do the best we can.
Yeah. What's going on? I just have a little, what's going on the farm?
Putting things to bed.
Yeah. Well, like you said, all those things dying, and there's a certain beauty to it, too. I mean, a big frost comes and kind of, let's just shut down and,
everything
and clean
goes,
up.
Whoop, turns shut a different,
down,
color,
yep, different color,
flops down on the ground.
Gather things together, start making them compost piles, and move the compost that was working all summer back out in the field. And in my case, I moved it out to some garlic beds. And this week, I'm planting garlic. Yes, garlic gets planted this time of year, at least the hardneck garlic that I plant. It grows over the winter, starts coming up when all those bulbs, it's a bulb. Think of all the daffodils.
So you just stick
stuff.
A clove.
Oh, yeah.
How far down into the ground?
As far as my thumb. And
one
I have,
thumb
and,
length.
And I have pretty small little stubby thumbs. Just push it down. Now, the pointy end goes up. The kind of rounded end goes down. And really, that really helps to make a pretty head. I mean, if you get it in crooked, it'll grow anyway, but it'll kind of be folded in on itself.
So it doesn't freeze all winter long?
Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's like your daffodil bulbs. Also, I do mulch with with a lot of straw and hay and whatever.
Okay.
So we've got some good old round bale, actually prairie hay, hay that was cut off of our neighbor's prairie. It's in big round bales.
Prairie hay. Now, doesn't that sound picturesque? Prairie hay. I'll take some prairie hay, please.
Yeah. Anyway, it was there. It was right next door. And I hope I've put the... Well, I try to do this every day. Get those round bales headed right. So once you get it started, you can push and keep it rolling. Yeah? You can unroll
the round bales. They just do that. How cool.
It works almost all the time. Not all the time. But anyway, three cheers for garlic. That's what's going on the farm. Well, I've got a few upcomings here to talk about. I talked to Connie Lawrence at Wheatsfield Food Co-op here in Ames, and there's something going on that one should always celebrate. There's a cheese fest coming up. Samples, demos, classes, savings every day. Cheese fest at Wheatsfield.
And Connie is a very knowledgeable cheesemonger. She used to make her own goat's cheese. Mm-hmm, she knows what she's about.
So, well, this sauerkraut tart. I said, Connie, I need some Munster. She said, you'll want this kind, and she just puts it right in your hand. That's November 1st through the 3rd. 3 days, money saving.
20% off.
Oh boy!
Yeah, I'm going to go in and buy myself some of Kevin Dietzel's cheese wheel. The one that I like with the burnt oak, is that what it's called?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Who would think you could put that? That really is good.
Oh, it's so good. What's the name of his farm? I can't remember.
Lost
Lake Farm. Yeah.
There's some good local cheese. There's some cheese that isn't all that local.
Connie will have all of it at Wheatsfield.
It's good cheese. Yummy, coming up. And we have something else coming up, too.
Oh, yes.
This is something to talk about around the kitchen table.
This is a local service for women. It's titled the Post-Kavanaugh Women's Sharing Support. It's a free workshop. It says share your reactions in a safe space, your reaction to the Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford hearings and the recent murders of women. Learn ways to soothe yourself and connect with others. Because this is led by a psychologist. A small group discussions will have trained facilitators. So this is offered free as a community service. Women...
What's the contact?
Right. The contact number, 515-232-5340. And it will be at the Universalist Unitarian Church on Saturday, November 10th at 10 a.m. to noon.
Very good. Yeah. Very good.
For women.
Yeah. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen Listen every Tuesday. Today we talked about sauerkraut and potatoes and Halloween. We'll go out with a tune called The Dark Hollow Blues. Trick or treat, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Support this community radio station. Support from people just like you make this show and lots of other great programming happen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We have had fine engineering and some great advice and a good joke by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.